Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And this podcast is brought to you by GoToMeeting. You know, if you're not using a web conferencing tool or a service is kind of clunky that you have, use my first choice, GoToMeeting. Because GoToMeeting is probably the easiest to use. You could turn a call into an instant online meeting in just one click. It's affordable. As many meetings as you want for just $49 per month. It's extremely secure and will substantially reduce meeting-related expenses. Now, you can try GoToMeeting free for 30 days, but you must visit gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for your free 30-day trial. And how are you? And are you ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast? How are you? Boy, it's been a crazy week. I'm here to tell you that. This is Andrew Horowitz. And where are we? Episode number 160. And if you haven't been paying attention, you must be out on some trail hiking somewhere, because I got to tell you something. It has been all over the news. It's been everywhere, in the face. Anybody I talk to, my kids, the maid, the car dealer, the guy at the news place. I mean, you know, from top to bottom, everybody's talking about what happened this week when it came to the U.S. markets and the global markets. We're going to cover some of that. Have a lot of fun with it, hopefully, kind of figuring out what happened. We have a great guest that's going to be with us today. His name is John Markman. We've had him on before. He's a really a great guy. I consider him a mentor. He is also an author by a fabulous book. If you've ever read The Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, which is the commentary insights on the life and times of Jesse Livermore. He actually wrote a whole different kind of way of looking at this, how to investigate a lot of the details. But I really want to talk to him about a little bit of a different situation. Really, I want to talk to him about some things concerning, things that he looks at that he often sends me, turning into buy signals, sell signals, pressure in the market, looking at sell stops, looking at, when to buy, and then talking about Thursday. We'll get to that in a second. We have lots to talk about, though. I mean, a lot. So where do we begin? We talked a lot about this on the DH Unplugged this week, which we did, fortunately, it was actually delayed. We did this on Thursday night, so that worked out pretty well for us. But, what we did find was that the overall, situation when it came to the markets really started on Thursday, if you're looking for an explanation. It started with some additional panic out of Greece. You know, here's how it went real quickly. The timetable was that the morning came out, we saw some economic numbers in the U.S. They weren't so bad, as a matter of fact. I'll even go so far as saying they were moderately good. And then on top of that, we saw a press conference with Jean-Claude Trichet, who is the president of the ECB, and he is the gentleman who makes the rules in terms of kind of like the Federal Reserve chief, like Bernanke, for the whole European Union. And basically what he did was that he held rates steady. No kidding. I mean, they're going to raise rates these days in that area? I don't think so. So we had that happen, and then from there what we had was a vote in Greece that the austerity measures that were going to be implemented in order to get the bailout from the Eurozone and the IMF was passed. Immediately after that, rioting and strikes were all over Greece and were creating major, major problems. Now, this is now getting into the mid-afternoon or mid-morning area, 11:30, 12 o'clock. Volume started picking up a bit, but one of the things we noticed that was very weird and out of the ordinary was the yen. There was massive buying in the yen. As a matter of fact, the dollar to the yen exchange, that combo on the currencies, was a differential of 5%. The dollar went down. The yen went up by 5%. The dollar also went up against the basket of currencies by about 1.5% during that time. So in other words, the dollar was rising, but the yen was rising even more. Why is that? Well, that's your classical flight to safety. When people are looking for a safe haven, they'll do it through the dollar and they'll do it through the yen. That's just what happens. the unwinding of carry trades and the unwinding of positions and where they're placing their money temporarily as a safekeeping place is in those two places. So we saw this massive move up of the yen, and all of a sudden we started to see the market drop off. Now, there really wasn't anything else that happened at that point. There was no news. There was nothing else really that was suspicious in the markets. But all of a sudden, this massive 800-point move down compared to where it was in a matter of 20 minutes, and then a 500-point move up in a matter of 10, 15 minutes right afterwards was nothing less than horrifying. It was nothing less than, I got to tell you, I've been there through 87. I've been there through a lot of the times, obviously, through 2007, the 2000s. This was very, very strange because it was such a media drop-off, essentially a crash of the system. No question about it. It was a crash of the system. Why? They say there was a fat finger trade where somebody pushed the millions. Instead of the millions, they pushed the billions number on an EC on one of their ECNs or one of their machines to get a big trade off on possibly an S&P future or an E-mini. There was something that happened there that was really out of the ordinary. But what's really interesting is, you know, why is this happening? Earnings have been coming in pretty solid. You know, a few companies here and there have not been doing so well. But we talked about this in a couple of weeks ago, I think about 2 or 3 weeks ago in one of our Monday morning commentaries, was that mutual fund managers, hedge funds are pretty much all in at this point. Where do they go from here? What happened is the massive volume we saw was clearly an indication that institutions are selling. Institutions are selling. They take down everything. We also heard that it's possible, that there was a hedge fund blow-up. Maybe they were long the euro. Maybe they were long the yen. Maybe they had something happen that there was a massive call on margin and they had to get out and they just blew out everything that was there. On the other hand, we also heard that this could have been a cascading effect from a incredible amount of pressure on the downside that hit stops left and right. I mean, it just stops kept going and going, the sell stops that were put in previously. So all these things that are going on are in the background of real problems in Greece and in Ireland and in Italy and in Portugal and Spain. And of course, a little bit in we'll call it Europe in general. We see the pullback in China clearly that's in a bear market now. We've seen this before. One of the reasons is that they have decided to slow down their economy. But at the same time, it is affecting us globally. Even though the U.S. is actually looking much better right now, where we have jobs growth that has recently occurred, we're seeing earnings that are doing very well. We are seeing the unemployment rate at 9.9% and the underemployment rate at about 17.1%, but we saw a great jobs number on Friday. Now, a lot of people would say, oh, wait a minute, that 290,000 print was a lot of census and government workers. Actually, it wasn't. There's only 60,000 people that were hired from the area of census workers or government workers on that number. We thought it would be a lot higher. So this is a quality number. But we have a lot of things in the background, a lot of uncertainty. We have financial reform happening or not happening or maybe do happening or we don't. I don't know. We have big banks being broken up or maybe not. We have now all of a sudden the offshore drilling. That's not happening. Well, maybe it will happen. And, you know, it just goes on and on and on with a lot of the things that are going on, higher taxes that are going to be hitting us, a possible higher dividend tax. I mean, just there's all this uncertainty right now, and markets don't appreciate that, even though individual stocks may be showing extremely good potential. They still got hit. So what we found was over the last few weeks, we saw that our trend and our indicators were starting to say, you know what, things are getting a little bit out of hand here from a volatility. They're picking up a little bit, but we started breaking through some of our trends. We actually pulled back our portfolios for the TDI managed growth strategy to about a 50% in position in the market, 15% hedged against that. So right now, as we're sitting here, we're about 35% long, which isn't good in a correcting market. But we still like a lot of the individual positions we have. And you know what? We've seen this before. And the truth of the matter is that the earnings are coming through. If we do see this package, they're estimating between 600 and 800 billion. I'll tell you that again. 600 to $800 billion in a rescue package in the Eurozone to backstop the banks, kind of like our TARP of a year ago, because of what's happening over there. They're looking to do a nuclear option. Forget the bazooka. We're into a nuclear option here that's going to be supported probably by most of the Eurozone and maybe even the IMF. If that happens, you know, there's going to be two things that happen. First, it's going to be a confession of the problems that they have here, but it will also be a backstop that will be very, very helpful. So we're looking to see if we see a run that way. We saw that. And you can see that the problem and the concern about the currency and the it's all showing up in gold and silver, and it's really showing up at the heart of alternative currencies. Again, the yen, the dollar, even though the dollar has been coming up, generally speaking, gold has been coming up. Oil was smacked down pretty well, though. So, you know, when we're looking at the market right now and the environments right now, it is time to be patient. It is not a time to just jump in. There are positions we like. We like, you know, companies like Avico, which is an LED play. We like, for example, we just picked up a small position in U.S. Steel and even Lululemon. The gaming plays that we had, I told you about those, have been doing spectacularly. You look at the gaming plays like the Bally's and the WMS Shufflemaster, they've been doing absolutely terrific. These are stocks that we've also mentioned on DH Unplugged. So take a look at those as some ideas that we've had. But you know what? You need to be very careful and be very patient right now until this whole storm passes, because this is a storm and it's a very vicious one. What we're going to do is, I wanted to get some time ahead of things with you here and talk to you about that. So much to talk about. But I also want to get to our friend John Markman and talk to him about all the things. He's a lot smarter than I am. Talk to him about all the things that are happening in the market and how he sees things. So we'll gear up. We'll get to him. We'll be right back. Sit tight. Hold on. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 160. We'll be right back. All right, we're back with John Markman, and we're going to talk about a couple of different things, and then we're actually going to go to another guest today who John actually introduced me to, and he's going to talk about some things called parabolic options. We'll talk about that in a minute with Mr. Lansing, but right now, John, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. Been a couple of fun days out there, hasn't it been?
Well, I think you mean the word fun ironically, don't you?
Slightly ironically. Yeah, tongue-in-cheek sometimes people would say it, or facetiously.
Well, it's fun if you like. Let's say you have the sport of you enjoy the sport of jumping into a washing machine and getting spun around.
Yeah, well, that can be fun.
And then spit out the other side, right. and then thrown out of a building.
Right. Or maybe for fun, you like to actually put yourself inside of a microwave and turn it on.
That would be another thing. Or it would be fun if, let's say, that you recognize that a top was building over the last month, and you saw that there was a lot of volume coming into the market on down days, and not very much volume coming into the market on up days, and you noticed a big rounding pattern, and you basically stepped off the train, and then watched the train basically hurtle off into space.
Yeah,
that might be. Well, actually,
if you would have, John, seriously, if you would have thought that to stay out of things because the market was showing us that volume was, you know, not so great on up days and much heavier on down days, we could say pretty much for the last 6 months you would have not been too heavily invested in this market. Wouldn't you agree?
Not exactly, because for most of that time, the market was rising up along its 20 day average.
Mm-hmm.
So from the February low until the middle of April, although there was higher volume on up, on down days than on up days, the market was still continuing to rise up along its 20-day average, which is a very, very common momentum move. What really happened in the middle of April was that you started to have more churn. You had not just these up days that were weak in volume, and the down days were strong in volume, but you had the market going sideways. And as the market went sideways, you had basically, in technical terms, all the momentum indicators as well as the actual indexes were rolling over. Until you had about 3 or 4 days there towards the end of April, beginning of May, where it started, the big index started to trade below their 21-day averages. And after basically they broke an uptrend that dated back to the beginning of February, they broke.
Yeah, we saw
sort of like putting a lot of rocks into the bottom of a wet paper bag. You know, you can put them in for a while and nothing happens, and then suddenly you put in one more and the bottom breaks out and all the rocks fall out.
You know, we actually saw a lot of that, but at the same time, individual securities didn't all show that. But it also goes to show you how the market, while it is a market of stocks, it still is a stock market, and that, you know,
a very clever epigram. You should trademark that.
You think so?
Yeah,
you've never heard that before.
I just made that up.
What happened is there that, you know, we pulled back and probably took off about 20 or 30, maybe even 40% of our positions and our exposure. But it was still, I mean, you look at Thursday, and Thursday was a very, very difficult day because not only the volume and velocity, but talking about the volatility and extreme levels of movement in individual positions and in markets, for that matter,
I don't think we really understand what happened. I don't think anyone really understands what happened on Thursday. I think what happened on Thursday with the Dow dropping down 995 points, something that had never happened in the history of the stock market. A move of that magnitude, that quickly, that was also quickly reversed. It's unprecedented. So we have to. I don't think we really understand what happened. People have been talking about a fat finger, in other words, somebody pressing the wrong button at an exchange or at a large brokerage. I don't think that really makes a lot of sense. I've talked to a lot of market makers today, top traders. Nobody really seems to have a good explanation for it. So I think we don't really know what happened. Some people have said maybe it was an incident of cyber terrorism. You know, who knows? The bottom line is that something strange happened, and what's the result? The result, Andrew, is something very, very important, and that is a lack of trust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have lost trust in the government. They've lost trust in their currency. They've lost trust in markets. They've lost, I mean, Catholics have lost trust in certain ways with their hierarchy, the priests. And now, after a 15-month bull market in which people were starting to get a little bit more comfortable with stocks, the exchanges or something happens where the bottom falls out in the middle of the day and everybody stops a run and they're left wondering what the heck happened. And, you know, it's hard to repair that kind of trust. I don't care what the answer is as to what exactly happened on Thursday. That lack of trust, I think, is going to linger with investors for quite a while.
Yeah, this just takes us all the way back to almost over a year ago, when people were worried about, you know, what's the worst can happen. In the old days, the quote-unquote old days, what's the worst can happen? Something's going to drop off 1%, 2%, what, 3%, what's going to happen? I mean, that drop of 9% intraday, yes, it did capture back much of it, but, you know, that was kind of reminiscent of the TARP hearings. Remember when they were going back and forth to approve the TARP and things were just all over the place? And who wants to be involved in that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's like a bad marriage.
So,
yeah.
So when it comes to,
not that I know anything about that.
No, of course not. So when it comes to the things like using charts and data points now, what happens? Does that skew a lot of the numbers? If you use the end of day numbers, it's fine. But do we look at it from a selling pressure day?
I've talked to some market makers and some big traders. You know, there were real trades that occurred during that drop. Some of them may be reversed, some of them may not. But the whole idea of the technical analysis is that, you know, certain selling points, a lot of selling pressure is generated at support and resistance points. And if sales really were made at these certain points we saw yesterday, they're going to still present a lot of resistance as on the way up and support on the way down. So whether or not they were real or not, whether or not they were in some way somebody's mistake or some incident of terrorism or some act of God, I think that it will have a real impact going forward.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. So, well, let's talk about sell stops. I know that a lot of times when you run your portfolios, you talk about sell stops. There's different types of sell stops. We call things soft stops, which are more like alerts. There's hard stops. There's trailing stops. But, you know, if you had in hard sell stops, let's say of a stock that's trading at 50 and you want to, say, have a 5% sell stop from there, and it was hard-coded in for, you know, $2.50 under, yesterday was a disaster.
Right, and here's the deal. So no professional trader will ever put in a hard stop in this system.
Mm-hmm.
It's like telling the market maker, rob me.
Right.
Or the electronic version thereof, because other people in the system can see your stop. It just says, rob me. So no professional is going to do that. It's mostly retail investors who put in sales stops. Why do they do that? It's convenient. So they're trading off something that's convenient so that they can put in a stop and think, oh, well, in a normal market, on a normal day, if it falls below this level, I'm out and I can, you know, go ahead and take my profit or take a small loss or whatever. But you're in a lot of, just like in a lot of other things where we trade off convenience for safety, you can do it 1,000 times and nothing bad will happen. But that 1,001th time can kill you.
Yeah.
And that's what happened in this case. You put 1,000 sales stops out there, 9 times out of 10, it's fine. But in a day like yesterday where they run the stops, you know, the market goes down 995 points in 5 minutes, it killed you.
Yeah, it hit stops.
And so I think that it's something that you're going to really see people be very, very, well, they'll simply decide not to put in hard stops anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact of the matter is they shouldn't have anyway, but they didn't realize why, and now they realize why. It's sort of like, you know, we always make these trades off for convenience and safety. Let's say, for instance, you have a credit card, and you hand it off to some kid at a restaurant. Well, you know, in the back of your mind, you realize that's not a good idea, right? Because he can copy down the number and call and order things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you do it because it's convenient.
Right.
Well, if you ever get it's stolen and you have an incident of identity theft, you realize, well, that's dumb. I'm not going to do that anymore. You start paying cash.
Right. So it's kind of like the lesson learned, you know, okay, I'm not going to do that again, and I'm not just going to let my investments, you know, for convenience to sit there and bake and do all these things. I'm with you on that. I'm with you. So what happens, though, you know, when right now, I guess we would both consider this a downtrending market, at least for some time, whether it's a day, a week, a month, whatever it is. What is it that you, John Markman, look at, and because you're really good at this, you know, where do you say, okay, you know, the trend is changing here. I am going to start committing a little bit more money into blank sector or to this ETF or to this stock. Well, you know, let's stay with sectors and ETFs. Where does that come from, and how do you kind of go into that? Because right now it's looking generally like everything's in a downtrend around the world. I mean, most everything.
Right. You know, it's amazing to me how quickly we've switched from what was really a very nice uptrend into a downtrend. For the United States had been in sort of a bubble for the last 2 months, because Europe has been trending down for all year, and China has been trending down since November.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I remember very vividly that happening back in 2008, where if you recall, kind of it's not that long ago now, but if you just throw your mind back to the middle of 2008, before the really bad part of the bear market happened. In 2008, the market was trending down at the beginning of the year. Then it fell quite a bit on bear stearns. When bear stearns was resolved, it went back up. It was about flat. Then it kind of trended down all into July, and then you had a situation happening with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That was resolved, and the market went back up in the summer. And all summer long, from about July all the way into the end of August, the S&P was still only down about 10% for the year, which is bad, but not terrible. But all that time, Europe and China were trading off, had already rolled over into a bear market. And that was a great signal that the United States would follow. And this is something that I've been writing about in my letter for the last, you know, 4 months. You know, Europe has been horrible for months. China has been horrible for months. So the question is the United States really going to be an island in this incredibly, you know, interconnected world? Can the United States do well while these two other major parts of the world, the stocks, you know, decline? Probably not. So this was one of the main reasons that I began recommending my newsletter customers to set tight stops at the end of April, and basically we were out of most things by the end of last week.
So when it comes to
that's the downtrend.
Right.
So China was in a downtrend and Europe was in a downtrend. The expectation was that the United States would follow. Now Obviously, markets fall a lot faster than they go up. So now we're back. We're heading back towards probably to the February lows. Now, what happens next? Well, ideally, you know, we'll hit those lows, maybe test yesterday's lows, and then sort of flatline along the bottom, and then we'll wait for wounds to heal and whatnot. And with any luck, you'll have something similar to February, where the market will start to levitate a little bit, and eventually the S&P will move above its 20-day moving average again, and we can start to see stocks levitate backwards, maybe towards the summer rally high. That's the hope. The other thing that can possibly happen is that you have in the United States something similar to what already happened in Japan and China and Europe, and that is that it just keeps on going down due to lack of trust and fears that the sovereign debt crisis in Europe becomes unraveled, that it's not just the Greece, but Spain and Portugal and Italy, United Kingdom and Ireland, which have similar troubles, will be called on their bluff by the bond market.
And what do you do now in terms of thinking, or what do you think now that last time we saw that the Asian nations and emerging markets turned around and moved higher before, again, they were the precursor to the rally, if you look at the charts.
Right, not Europe so much, but definitely China.
Yeah.
So I would definitely look for, keep your eye on the big ETF following China, which is FXI, or the index that follows the Shanghai market, which is SSEC.
Mm-hmm.
That's an index, not a fund. Watch to see if those base and start to move up. And if they do, then you can either move some money into those or just expect the United States to follow, a couple months later.
Hmm. Okay. Well, good stuff. I know we have a short time together today, so we're going to end it right there. I mentioned that you can visit and check out all of John's work. He has a great newsletter service, and it provides you just an amazing amount of insight. It's tell us a little bit about that real quickly.
Sure. I have two newsletters, a short-term letter and a long-term letter. The short-term letter is called Trader's Advantage, and you can see it at johnmarkman.com. We look for stocks and options to buy for a few days to a few weeks. Not day trading, but not long-term investing. And I also have a long-term letter that is called Strategic Advantage, and people can find that at markmancapital.net. They can sign up for a free 2-week trial.
All right, good stuff. John Markman, always a pleasure, always my pleasure to have you, and I thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, it looks like we may have a little bit of technical difficulties bringing on John, but we'll bring him on, John Lansing, that is. I just got a little note passed to me that timing is not working out, so that was okay. That was going to bring him on because I want to talk about some of these options. We'll bring him on another time. But I did have a few other things that I wanted to talk to you about. Anyway, I had a good question that came in. I'm going to bring that up right now. This question, this is interesting. Dave Macri writes to me, "Hi, Andrew. I'm an avid listener, even with the tongue-in-cheek jabs directed at Canada. LOL. Can you please explain to me why Citigroup doesn't buy back the government stake instead of just selling it through the open market? It seems like a logical plan. Reduce the float, increase the share price. They did manage to pay back the government's quote-unquote loan somehow. Why can't they do the same with the government stake? Thanks a lot, Dave from Toronto, Canada." The problem is that why can't they do that? You know, that would be a good thing to do, but let's be very honest about something. If you have been suckered into the thought that Citigroup actually has the money to do that, that would be a wonderful event. The fact is that they want to actually have outsiders buy it. There is no way that Citigroup has the amount of money in their coffers right now. They've been trying to build up through backdoor bailout and through all sorts of schemes that the Fed has been pushing money into these banks for some time, particularly Citi and Bank of America. And what's happening here is that would be, of course, beneficial to their shares, and we'd see a higher EPS. But it would be very, very problematic from the aspect of transferring the value from one side of the books to the other. They need the free cash. And then what happens is they would much rather, the government would much rather, get the money from private investors. If you think about what's happened over the last couple of years, essentially what has happened is that the government has looked to not only provide money on their side, which we will pay, of course, through taxes, but what they've also done is demanded that these banks go to the open markets and grab money through share offerings, through bond issues, through preferreds, whatever they can to, you know, to bulk up their balance sheets and to shore them up. Now, the thing is that when you look at this question in particular of why Citigroup couldn't do it, there's no benefit for them to do that. And to get money from the individuals out there is a much better prospect, because all that would happen in the end of all that is that the government would have to push more money into Citi to keep them, you know, not only solvent, but keep their ratios in line with making sure that they had enough assets against their liabilities, or, you know, depending on how you look at the loan ratios. And there's still a lot of problems when it comes to the commercial backed mortgages and a lot of the default rates, which we did see a tick up today in that of or this week we saw it about up to about 7.5%. Even though that many of the consumer side of things and credit card default ratios have been dropping, we're still seeing the edge of, or the tip of the iceberg in the commercial backed area. So I hope that answered your question. At least that's my opinion of why that is the case. Anybody could ask me a question, of course. Feel free, write to Ask Andrew at TheDisciplinedInvestor.com. A couple of things I also wanted to talk about when it comes to the markets right now. We talked about the jobs number. I want to kind of bring that back for 1 second and talk to you about the jobs. I also want to talk to you about China. I want to also talk to you about one more thing that Australia is doing that I want you to keep your eyes real and your ears wide open to. But let's start with the jobs number. So we saw this 290,000 print on the jobs number. And, you know, a lot of people have asked me, you know, is that a good number? Is that a bad number? I mean, there is some clear evidence that there is work. There are workers going back in small numbers to some places, GE's hiring and a variety of other machinery and manufacturers. Manufacturers, in fact, which we didn't think would be hiring right now, are actually doing some hiring. And that's a good thing. And is it enough? Well, we have millions of people that are out of work, so it's not going to be enough for a long time. At this rate, we're talking about somewhere about 2.5 years to get the workforce back to where it was 2 years ago. So it's going to take a long time for that to happen at any rate. Even if we ramp it up and double it, we're talking about 1.5 years until things get back to normal, quote-unquote normal. So, you know, what's happening with the jobs market is much better than we saw, even though the initial claims are still in the 400-plus range on a weekly basis. We need to see that somewhere about 250 before we could really feel good that the economy is in a growth cycle. But the question really then remains is, are we in a growth cycle? Are we in the top of a recovery? Where are we? It appears to us that we are in a recovery cycle, no question about that, where comps have been very easy looking back oftentimes on a year-over-year basis, right? Oftentimes when you see a comparative of one set of data points to another set of data points, it's from 1 year to the next, right? You see year-over-year numbers, et cetera. You see month-over-month, but usually we're looking at year-over-year. Well, clearly we're not seeing any kind of significant inflationary pressures, PPI pressures. Okay, that's interesting. We're seeing productivity gains slow down a little bit, which means the amount of, let's say, how much work the factories and manufacturers and companies can squeeze out of their workers. And at the same time, we're seeing production and capacity utilization kind of flatline, not really move up too much. This is all a sign of an inventory restocking cycle, which we have been seeing. And there is going to be a point where we're going to reach equilibrium, because in the past, when we thought prior to 2007, when we thought that the growth cycle would be an ever-flowing and an ever-wonderful process, what happened was that we had to keep almost a nonstop amount of inventory, and companies were willing to do so because they knew they would unload it over time. When everything shut down in 2008 and part of 2009, companies said, wait a second, we have all this inventory and we have to start selling it at fire sale prices. Well, that makes no sense. We're not going to let this happen again. So what they did was they started to work better at their inventory management systems. Okay, that was really smart of them. The next thing they did was realize that if they did get into a situation where growth returned, where people were starting to buy things again, they were not going to get themselves into a bind like they did last time. They were not going to get themselves into a situation where they have massive inventories that they would possibly have to worry about liquidating at below cost, below their cost pricing to get rid of it and to get rid of all the things that they had, which would cost them a lot of money. So what's happening is the inventory management systems through technology, through better management structures, through an re-engineering process has done an incredible job at bringing companies like many of the retail outfits, some of the manufacturers, the restaurants, a lot of the consumer discretionary style of companies in that sector to a much better level at inventory management. And the question is, and we have to wonder, where is the trend line going to stop? We saw material stocks like steel, for example, just pretty much fall off a cliff. We do like the steel companies right now, but we saw them fall off a cliff. And is that because orders aren't coming in? There's not a lot of opportunity moving forward. What's happening there? Well, what's happening there is that we did see some good numbers in the car area. Of course, Whirlpool came in with an amazing number with the cash for appliances, kind of like the cash for clunkers. But that isn't a never-ending stream. And what's happening is that the manufacturers and the end retailer know that they shouldn't just be ordering and ordering and ordering. So what they're doing is using good inventory management to make sure that they don't overdo it. So while a lot of people and investors are still looking at the inventory cycle and the inventory management in the old way, they were looking at the ramp up in a direct line, kind of a linear from bottom left to top right, when they should have been looking at it more geometrically. So we see now. We see that the restocking cycle, the retail cycle, is not a direct line in one direction. Just because we have 1 month that we see a 26% increase in housing starts and new housing sales or any of those numbers doesn't mean that's a continuation. It could be because we saw, for example, that there was a mad rush to do things because the housing credit, the special buyer's credit, was going to end. That does not mean that every single month forward that would continue. So now when you look at these numbers, we have to realize that I want you to think geometrically, that everything won't go up forever and everything won't go down forever. Okay, that's an important lesson for all of us. And when you're looking at positions, you know, what level does it fall to before it becomes a good buying situation? What level does it get to before it gets to a good selling situation? These are things we need to look at. You know, who would have thought that you look at a Baidu, a Google down below where it started the year, below its 50-day moving average. I mean, really in bad shape. Its chart looks awful. Apple just touching its 50-day moving average, down probably about, I think it's close to 10 or 15% from its high. You know, everybody thought Apple was just going to go up forever. Let's be honest. Apple was just going to go up forever. But it does come back. It reaches institutional support. It reaches retail support. Right now, it's on its 50. We think it's reaching its retail support. We're actually thinking about adding some to our portfolios very slowly because, again, in these market corrections, you don't want to do anything abruptly. Could Apple come down another 20 points? Absolutely. Absolutely. Could it come down another 50 points? Sure. Whether there's an economic slowdown around the world that slows things down, whether the iPad is not accepted, whether the iPhone's not being used, whether there's another product that comes out, who knows what the scenario is? Could Apple come out with a brand new product that launches it to the next level? Sure, absolutely. But where we stand right now is in a place that we want to look at the environment as one that is very geometric and it is flowing. It is not fixed. It is flexible. That's how you need to be with your investments right now. So think about those things. Think about the employment numbers that came out as a good number, as a good indication that there is some hiring coming back. And then the only thing that I want you to be aware of is what the cost factors will be for that hiring when it comes to individuals and companies. So in other words, we know that a lot of companies cut costs by slowing down on their or firing a lot of people. You know, if they start bringing people back, what is that going to cost? You know, we got to put that into the EPS structure. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about also China pulling back. So in China, there have been several different attempts at different levels to slow down the bubbling housing situation over there. There was from March to March, a 10% increase in housing prices in certain regions of China, and the Chinese government is doing their best to pull back on the overall loan availability, quality of loans, and also requiring banks to have a lot more backing and backstopping. So in other words, they're not going to get into a situation like we saw. Now, there are some people, Jim Chanos and a few others, that are saying that, you know, China is a bubble that's about to burst. Okay, that may happen. It may be happening right now. They're clearly in a bear market. The Shanghai market, Shenzhen, in over 20% takedown so far. And if you look at a chart, it looks pretty ugly, actually. And actually, if you want to look at some interesting charts, look at Greece, look at a lot of the European region, look at how they pulled back, and they don't look like they're so high off their March lows from last year. Interesting. The other thing that I want to mention to you is what happens when you start fighting City Hall. So when you start fighting City Hall, and let's take as an example what happened in Australia. In Australia, they decided that, you know, this is a country that really prides itself and works very hard at their mining and exploration export business. They're an export-driven country, essentially deriving their benefits for their country by the commodities that are under the earth and the things that they can actually dig up. Well, they have an incredible amount of mines and coal and all sorts of things over there, and their BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto and all sorts of companies are doing a lot of business over there. Well, they're making a lot of money. The Australian government, who has raised rates, I think, three or four times now to cool off their economy, an economy that really never went into a recession like many others, has decided to put on a super tax on the miners, that the miners will have to pay upwards of about a 53% tax on their profits. Now, wait a minute. Don't fight City Hall. If we're looking at a mining tax and we're looking at a tax by a government on miners, the miners that do business in Australia, that's not a good thing when it comes to the overall potential profits of these companies. And what's even more interesting is, and as you would have guessed, these companies have pulled back dramatically. Just look at any of these stocks. Look at BHP Billiton. Look at Rio Tinto. Look at those two, the two biggest players in that sector. They pulled back dramatically. Look at a company like Cliffs, CLF. They have a stake in a company in Australia as well. They pulled back dramatically on this news that happened pretty much out of nowhere. So when you look at this kind of situation, when we're looking at taxes, which China is now also looking at putting on a super tax on companies, when we're looking at taxes that are being raised on dividends in the United States, and that's going to cause a bit of a problem for those dividend-paying stocks. When we look at the overall process of what governments are doing right now, like the austerity plan in Greece, these are things that are beyond our ability to control, not things that we want to fight. We want to go with the flow because governments are much stronger than any market. We could see that by what the Fed did by flushing in money. We could see what happened in China with their record stimulus package. But you do not want to fight a government in any situation. You don't want to fight the Fed. You don't want to fight the government. It will be a problem. Just look at what's gone on in the financials ever since the financial reform bill has been brought up. Let's look at what happened with Goldman Sachs once the suit was filed for fraud. Let's look at the healthcare companies and the HMOs in particular. What happened when we saw the healthcare package come into play? So when you take all these things, and put it into a one complete and cogent sentence, the bottom line is that you don't want to fight City Hall, and be aware of that and be conscious of what's going on from a regulatory standpoint as well as a governmental legislative standpoint. So, and not to mention, all the side deals that always go on that seem to crush us in the middle somehow, us investors, us poor guys that are trying to make a couple of bucks, always seem to be getting right in the middle of all these situations. Last thing I want to talk about is oil. We're not, it's hard to be playing oil right now because oil has a mind of its own. And, you could do this a few different ways through ETFs. You could do this through, all sorts of different processes. You could buy the oil drillers. You could buy the companies that do some of the refining. You could do, you could buy the companies that do the deep waters like Transocean Rig or an Atwater, ATW. There's different players that you can, go out there. You can find some now that we think that are a little bit better off that are going to be drilling on land, because we think this offshore situation is pretty much kerplunked after this horrible situation that's going on right now off the coast of Louisiana and off the south coast of the United States. And, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger pulled out and is no longer supporting it. And I would be hard-pressed politically, I think, for anybody to be supporting it right now until we find out what the environmental impact is. So, I mean, I think we all agree with that, right? But when it comes to oil right now, oil is down significantly. And this is because the dollar has been moving up so dramatically as a safe haven play. So has the yen, as we had mentioned at the top of the show. So now when we look at this, is there an opportunity maybe to buy some oil? Because if the world all of a sudden is, you know, continuing on a bit of a growth path, and this is a bump in the road, nobody ever said there wouldn't be a bump in the road, but if you're continuing on a growth path, are we going to see oil back up maybe, let's say, 5% or even more? Right now it dropped from, what, 87 down to about 76 or so. We're talking about 10 bucks. We're talking about close to 12, 13% or so in the last week and a half. Even though we saw over the last month and a half inventory levels pretty high, we know that there's a lot of ships out there in the gulfs and in the seas of the world holding a lot of oil. We know there's a lot of inventory. But at the same time, we also know that the players out there, unless the dollar comes up and keeps on coming up, are going to try to push oil up. So take a look at some of the oil plays. There's USO, there's SEO, and there's a few positive ETFs and negative two-time ETFs. But the oil players we want to look at also is a company called St. Mary's, SM. Interesting play, Concho Resources, oil and gas and natural gas play. If you looked at Clean Energy this week, which is the natural gas slash program from T.Boo Pickens, it got slaughtered. I mean, just absolutely slaughtered. Ever since that Bad Barons article came out, it just got cremated. But Exxon also has a good play in this, and I'm not even going to talk about BP and Rig and all these companies, because right now we don't know the extent of the damage and how much they're going to have to, you know, come up with. But some of these other names that I'm mentioning here, I think that have some interesting opportunities, because we're not going to run out of need or the need for energy. I don't care how many hybrids we have right now and how green we want to be. We still need energy for transportation and for all the other things that we do in life. So take a look at that as an interesting idea. I think that you got to be very careful when it comes to oil, but yet at the same time, it may be a little bit oversold, just a little bit oversold. Let's see. I had one more thing I wanted to go over here with you. Let me find it. Hold on. Let me go back here. Hang on. Okay. Here it is. Got it. Okay. So, I think this is pretty interesting. We have a list of, I don't know, this must be 100 different ETFs. I think it's about 100 ETFs that we track, and we look at the ETFs from a country-specific standpoint, right? So we're looking at things like EWA, which is Australia, and EWZ, which is Brazil, and FXI, which is, and FXP, which is China inverse, and all the different ones of Germany and India and all that. And we're looking at two things. We're looking at a trend, and we have an algorithm that we built to figure out, okay, what's the trend here? Is it a short-term trend, up or down, long-term trend, up or down? And when we talk about short-term trend, up or down, we're talking about, okay, is it broken through a lot of resistance points right now? You know, where are things playing in terms of resistance and support levels? And where are things going to be if we want to start buying it, or do we want to get out of it, or even maybe even short it? You know, it's been a rough market to short, because every time you seem to get into a short position, you know, you get turned around and whipped around within 3 or 4 days or a week. You know, that's not a trend you want to play. The play is to follow the longer term trend right now, and that's kind of a better play. But I will tell you that on this list, I do not have one sector or country. Sector on the S&P 500, you know, the retail, home builders, discretionary staples. I have no sectors and no countries individually, whether it's Russia, Singapore, Spain, I don't care, that are either showing a short-term bull or long-term bull trend on the upside. Now, when we do start seeing the short-term bull trends turning around, that's where we start initiating positions back into those. But right now, everything across the board is red. The only thing that is green are inverse, which I'm sure you can imagine. You know, it's funny, because we had a high of the year of about up 7 or 8%, maybe even 9% on the S&P 500 domestically here. If you take a look at what's gone on, we are now at under zero. In other words, we're negative on the S&P, the Dow, and we're also negative on the NASDAQ. But if you look at the rest of the world, they're much more severely off, and it's really kind of scary to see how off they are. Even though we had this major rally here, you know, the fact of the matter is not only the market's off, but individual stocks are off 20, 30, 40% just from the last few weeks of what happened here. So this is kind of what it looked like in February. You know, it looks like it was going to continue down. And if you weren't on your toes watching for when that turn happened, you missed that next run. So we're going to talk about that in the future weeks. I'll try to remember to talk about maybe if there are any turns in any of those sectors that do show up here. But in the meantime, right now, this is telling us that, you know, you may want to look at holding off on any new buys and cutting down positions as they move past stop points, or, you know, if they start breaking trend on the downside, and then hold off and wait and be patient to reinvest again and move in. Again, that's what we're doing for our portfolios. I think we're net about 35% long right now after short hedges and cash positions, et cetera. So I think that's something you need to be aware of, and that's something that you need to do to be a disciplined investor. Discipline is what it's all about, you know, making sure the quanta fund, the techno process that we use, you know, whether you want to use just technicals, but stick to that process. And there are times, yes, you do break your rules, of course, but you do it for a good reason. And if it doesn't work out, you realize that you did break it, take the responsibility and move on. Well, that's going to be wrap it up. That's going to wrap it up for today. It's been a long week. I wrote a lot about what happened on the website at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. It is a discussion about what happened on Thursday. There's also a discussion of what we call a sneak peek into some of the things that we talk to our clients about with regard to our private website, our client-only website. Anybody that wants a test drive to that, go over there. And if you're wondering, whoa, is it time to invest? Is it not time to invest? You know where to find us. It's at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We do manage money, $50,000 minimum for our TDI managed growth strategy. If you want to see more about it, there's a 14-minute video. Go right there right now, right to the show notes from this particular episode. There'll be a box on the bottom that says, click here to see the virtual tour. Okay, until next time, thanks for joining me. This is Andrew Horowitz signing off from episode number 160, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.